we will be talking about the moon this evening. And we always start by talking about things that a planet is a personification of. Because when we're dealing with the planets, we're dealing with something that is an embodiment of one quality. That quality might be complex, but it is usually one thing and one thing only. Now, the most preeminent personification of the moon is motherhood. It's probably one of the most universal and archetypal symbols of all kinds. When Carl Jung wrote about four great archetypes, mother was certainly one of them. So this is universal. There's universally a reverence for mothers and a disregard of mothers. And both those qualities can be applied to the moon. A lot of mothers in a lot of cultures have a hard time. It's almost as if there is complete compensation in one life. Like early in life, the mother is revered, and a child couldn't think of living without having the mother. And then later on in life, the mother is often not treated well in a lot of societies. And I think it's a very difficult thing to live up to what people expect of you. And if you're associated with the whole divine principle of maternity, that's a stressful thing to live up to. Now, various societies have mothers. Deific mothers, Virgin Mary, Fatima, Sophia, Eve, Maya, Deva Matri, Kuan Yin, all of these are motherhood raised to the level of deity. And that's the kind of thing that it's hard to live up to. But in any society, even primitive society, the mother, because she is the mother, is the personification of fertility, of fecundity, of fructification. The moon produces things. And whether it's in astrology, whether it produces events, or whether it just indicates productivity in general, that is a quality of the moon that carries at all times. Now, humans are pretty much born whole. There's very little that's added on later. But it requires a lot of time for development. So even though a human is born whole, the whole process of crystallization or solidification or of forming things is the product of the mother. Now, most mothers, human mothers anyway, are not completely conscious of the building process that's going on inside of them. And as a consequence, it has a subconscious or a semi-subconscious quality to it. And that describes the moon very well. Very few of the things of the moon are completely in waking consciousness. So, things are mothered into existence, and that mothering quality is thoroughly a thing of the moon. But even after something is born and it's going through all of the development, it has to be fostered. And so the care and the protection and the feeding and cleaning and all of those kinds of things that are associated directly with motherhood are associated directly with the moon. This can mean something as simple as if the moon is prominent in somebody's horoscope in one of the professional houses, it would mean that this might be a person who does cleaning or who works with food or something like that. But in any case, that basic instinct to nurture things is what the moon is a personification of. Now, because it isn't completely waking in its consciousness, there is something biological about it. motherhood belongs as much to nature as it does to humanity. And the biological elements have something built in to take care of things so that there is a certain amount of autonomy in motherhood. And those things could be called instinctual. We'll say a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But at any rate, the moon is the nurturer, and it nurtures thoughts and emotions and suggestions and all of those things. Constantly busy, as the old statement goes, a mother's work is never done. The next personification is an expansion of the previous one, because there's one mother that everyone knows, and that is Mother Nature. Only Mother Nature is much more positive than any human mother. The nature is so positive that people who spend a lot of time in nature either have to be very passively receptive, or they have to toughen themselves in some ways. I've even wondered whether the tough qualities of people who are rednecks, or so-called rednecks, are there because it's from people who have to be tough, because who can stand up? You know, you can't beat nature. Even very shortly after a volcano has gone off, things start growing, they start developing, and they start producing. You can't beat nature. And any attempt to do so is suicidal. We try to do it with pesticides and things like that, and it turns out to be very clearly suicidal. So there is something about nature that is positive, that is so universal that its life cannot be beat. And the moon isn't quite that positive in a horoscope. But the moon just never gives up with its caregiving. You know, it would sooner sacrifice itself than give up. And that's a psychological quality that you find with the moon wherever it is in the horoscope. Now, because it's semi-unconscious, or in the case of nature, the unconsciousness sometimes seems to be more than the consciousness, there's a blindness to nature. It just sort of gropes along, but there's great wisdom in it, but the wisdom works in such a way that it isn't deliberate like human wisdom. So, like if you're thinking of trying to get a feel of how the moon is in your consciousness, you can't think about too much deliberation, because it isn't like that. And there's something integral about the moon as nature. You know, everything is in nature, and everything is interdependent in nature. Everything is coevolutionary. And so there has to be that when you're functioning with lunar consciousness and you're trying to be purely lunar, you just have to sort of go into automatic pilot and you know, and sort of go with what's flowing inside of yourself. Nature and the moon, and especially the womb that is ruled by nature, is teeming with wetness and warmth and life that just is undeniable. There's perpetual change that goes with this kind of wetness. You put water anywhere. You can start even with sterile water, and within a few seconds there will be spores or something growing in it. It's very hard to have a biological sterile situation with when water is involved. Obviously, we're saying that the moon is closely involved with water. We'll come to that a little bit more. So the moon and nature are local functions of an ongoing large-scale evolution. They're constantly giving birth to what is new, and things are coming out from them all the time. Nature has qualities that are like the moon. And if we can learn to live with those instinctual qualities, some of them are quite beneficial. If we think about nature, it's self-cleansing. It is self-healing. And even our emotional nature, as ruled by the moon, is like that. It's sort of an unassuming kind of thing in the way it cleans things and keeps things progressing within unbroken integrity. Let's look at another instinct, another personification closely related, and that is instinct. It's the personification of something unconscious or something, how would you say it, a cunning-like quality that works in us. And in most people who are trying to awaken spiritual self-consciousness, this is a hard thing to deal with. Because in moments when we aren't deliberately self-conscious, what happens is instinct will take over. And it's kind of a creepy thing when it does. You know, like, we don't consciously measure out all of the fluids for our digestion, for example. But these are things that are done without our conscious intervention. And obviously, they're benign. But there are other things like self-defensive qualities that come with the moon. And when they're present, it's not a very pleasant world at all. Sometimes this instinctual quality of the moon is called feminine intuition. Now that is really a misnomer, because it is true that women are more open to intuition because their etheric vital body, their inner nature, is more positively charged and they are more responsive to intuition. But instinct is something much different. Instinct is something that is right in the biological workings of things. And so you have to be very careful about which is which. I think I'm going to pass on some of these things. Some of these get awfully long. The moon, in its instinctual nature, represents something that is primitive. It represents qualities going to animal-like qualities. So things that are rhythmic or cyclical behavior of one kind or another, mating urges, even death urges, are ruled by the moon. The moon, as much as it is the builder of form, if form keeps on building, it hardens one in, and the moon is as much of a death dealer at the end of life as it is in the beginning. The moon and Saturn together especially, it's that whole calcification and hardening of form. Another personification of the moon is imagination. Whether it is a mother who is gestating or whether it is an instinctual function, there is the quality of pictorial imagination. I don't know if it's ever happened to you. It happens to a lot of people that when you start functioning on an instinctual nature and you are protective as the moon is, it happens inside of you that without intending it to, you get pictures of what could go wrong. What, you know, it's real horrible. I used to work at one time with a very heavy and extremely sharp, sharp as a razor blade paper knife. And when I worked around that, I had to be careful because there was a pictorial imagination. I could always see my fingers being cut and cut very badly. Mix that together with a self-destructive character, and you've got a really nasty mix. But that is pictorial imagination, that is instinctual, and that it is negative. If you're protective, this, you know, instinct is sort of the opposite of being faithful. If you're faithful, you don't have to be that overly protective. But there are other kinds of imagination that are pictorial for the moon, and one is that it produces soul pictures. It produces internal images, which poets like, internal images that indicate the nature of feeling or the nature of thoughts that you're having. They are not like you could take with a camera, though you can train yourself to make them that way, but there seem to be living graphic images that when you look at them, you say, yes, that is what this feeling would look like if I could materialize it. In fact, that is such a materialization. The moon has a whole language of pictures and symbols and emblems and images and icons and things like that that it has. And usually, again, because the moon is a very subjective planet and it's a very personal planet, each one's symbols are very often a very personal thing. One person might have one kind of image and it might mean something to them, and the other person having the same image, it means something different. There is something universal, but this is another kind of imagination. But all of the things that we have said so far are only partly conscious. There is another kind of imagination that it takes a lot to develop. And the way you can tell that you're really developed in it is if you can do it slow. Slow to the point of stopping. And that is creating a simple internal image. Without having to draw it or anything like that. You could draw it if you wanted to. But if you can hold an imagination as though it were an object and turn it in your consciousness and look at it from different perspectives and hold it for a good long time, like a few minutes, that is a very difficult thing to do. But that is a function of the moon. There are three planets that have a lot to do with the moon, with imagination, and they are Moon and Neptune and Venus. If you find all of those three planets together, they are all imaginative. And if the imagination gets consolidated into a form, you can bring Saturn in. Probably the most imaginative mix of planets is the Moon and Neptune. Now, it's an interesting thing. When we talked about the sun, we said that the sun represented conscious will. And the moon is the counterpart. It is the planetary opposite of the sun. And it represents the feminine quality of imagination. And the spiritual masculine and the spiritual feminine work hand in hand with each other. They complement each other, so that it's hard telling whether the imagination draws out the will or whether the will informs the imagination. And this is an important thing to know, because what we've just been talking about, the conscious use of imagination to produce internal images, or even external if you can do that well with them. There are some people that can imagine so well that they can imagine something suspended in the air before them and other people can see it. But in doing that, that is an exercise in a lot of spiritual disciplines, not for the sake of the imagination. It is an exercise for the sake of will. Because the imagination, if it is not under the control of will, it will just puddle away almost immediately. Therefore, if you want to develop an extremely powerful willpower, is just start imagining a very simple object. Hold that object in your consciousness as long as you can hold it. In the first time you try doing it, it will seem as though you can't even make an image. You can't even make something like a triangle. Now, it's easy to make an image that's fleeting. And if you make too many fleeting images, especially early in your development, and you have what is called a rapid imagination, That's not a healthy thing. Something inside of you has taken over, and when that takes over, that makes you psychonegative, and you incline yourself toward mediumship and things like that. But this is a case that if you can make a stopped action imagination and hold that in your consciousness, you have a very powerful will. This is the kind of will, especially through imagination, that people who become magicians and healers, that they wield, because they, in order to be effectual, they have to have the imagination and be able to inform it into something, the will, and be able to inform it into something. So we're talking about one of the greatest powers that a human being has, but it's a power that can't be developed by itself. It's just like the moon in the heavens. It gets its light and it gets its direction from the sun. And so the two have to work hand in hand. Another personification of the moon is the personification of impressionability or of memory. A few years ago, a psychological study was done, and it was surprising how many different kinds of cries a young mother could distinguish in a baby. It's like there is an impression that is carried through the air, through the sound, and a mother can very often know, this is a diaper change cry, or this is a growing pain cry, or something like that. But the ability to take an impression, an external impression, is what the moon is a personification of. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's only soft and suffering. When we talked about cancer, we said things like clams were ruled by the moon because they were so soft and impressionable that they had to have an exoskeleton to protect themselves, or some kind of shield to protect themselves. What we're talking about here is something that is soft and sensitive and surrendering, but yet at the same time that can hold something, and it holds it for a long time. Like memory impressions, or the impressions throughout all of your life, are stored so that even as an old person, you can recall images from childhood, and they're just as real as when you lived through them at the first time. And so that kind of impressionability. So if you find somebody with a sensitive moon, like we were talking about before with the moon in Neptune, that might not only be somebody who's an imaginative person, that might be a person who's extremely impressionable and carries around not only pictures, but what musicians or artists would call tone pictures or something of that nature. So it is an embodiment of impressionability and embodiment of subconscious memory. It has a remarkable ability to take in impressions and hold them. In fact, it can turn them. That's the thing, the funny thing. The breath record memory that is the photographic memory of everything that's happened to you, that is unchangeable. But if you start accessing that and bring that into your semi-conscious or subconscious memory, what happens there is you can distort that. We have a strange way of remembering what we want to remember and not remembering the things we don't want to remember. Psychologists can tell you all sorts of things like that. They can tell you about what are called masking memories. Like you will remember one thing because it's a pleasant memory, but it's easier to remember that than the thing that happened right next to it, and that was rather unpleasant. All right, I have an enormous amount of notes for this talk, so we'll have to cut back at every step here. It will be too much. From what we're saying here, it's clear that the moon represents a kind of consciousness. And you could call that the lower instinctual mind. When we talked about Mercury, we talked about a deliberating mind. A deliberating mind that followed a line of thought, or a deliberating mind that organized facts in such a way that they had a meaning, or a deliberative mind that was trying to get to some end. Well, the moon, as the lower instinctual mind, also tries to get to some end, but it isn't self-conscious about it. It is like an, what would you call it? A mind from the past. A vestigial mind, you might call it. There's a better word, but I can't think of it right now. So this works in us, and it governs a lot of things we do, especially if there is physical action. I can remember being a very deliberative person, being in circumstances where I could not perform certain functions that other people could with alacrity, because I was a person who did things with deliberation. And that's a slow thinking process, a cogitative process. And that, you know, and other people just sort of let things go to instinct. They knew what they wanted, and there was a natural kind of dead reckoning. You can almost use this kind of consciousness of the moon, depending on what planets it's with and what signs it's what sign it's in. But you can almost use the subconscious mind or this lower instinctual mind like a dog. You could say, "Sick 'em! You know, I want this," and it takes off and does what you want it to do. I usually don't want it. I don't want the kinds of things that the instinctual mind wants. In some ways, I am almost anti-instinctual, because I think if you want to become a perfectly deliberate, self-conscious being, or if you want to have the what would be called the Christ-like kind of consciousness that covers everything that nature does, but it covers it with the waking awareness of a divine being, to some extent, that cannot really coexist well in a human being with if that human being has a lot of instinctuality about it. Yes, that instinctual mind comes out in that way too, but we won't talk about it that at all. I guess you have enough of an idea of what's going on there. The moon, beside being a planet that has to do with a mentality, it's hard to call it a mentality when you're talking about the instinctual mind, but with that dead reckoning, cunning kind of quality, the moon is also a planet of emotionality. In fact, the moon represents the basic emotionality. If you put the moon in something like Aquarius, it has a difficult time, because the moon represents the excitability. And Aquarius is a pretty calm sign, Capricorn as well. And you can say with those kinds of positionings of the moon that this is somebody that's come to rebirth to not be excitable. They don't want to be fretful, they don't want to be restless, and they don't want to get into a turmoil real quickly. So if you think of somebody that is complete receptivity, as we've talked about with the impression ability, but at the same time reactive with that impression ability, you have a very good picture of the moon. And the reactivity is not like a mechanical reactivity, it is an emotional reactivity. You are stimulated, you're motivated to do something. We're talking about the excitement of motivation, the excitement of desire to do something, all of that depends upon the moon. The moon is the mother of all motivation, whether it is involved in the motivation or not. So if you were to think of somebody that was a basic emoter without anything else but maintaining the basics in mind, that would be what you would have from the moon. So the moon is very fluidic. The moon is very changeable. Women who are more ruled by the moon than men are said to be fickle and changeable and all those things. All those things are true, but you know, there are men that are extremely changeable too, but you could find that in a horoscope. But we're talking overall women, because of being more sensitive to the moon, that is true. But the to cast aspersion on that is with men who are basically, are often basically insecure about women. They try to put changeability and the inability to make up a mind, but to keep on moving and changing all the time. They say that's bad. They want something constant. I happen to think that somebody who can change, because I'm unchangeable in many ways, I happen to think it's very good for have the feminine quality of changeability. There's one set of feelings that is especially true to the moon, and that is the feeling of sympathy, empathy, condolence, which is one of the most misused words in the English language. You go to a funeral and you find people, I give you my condolences. Well, I have only one condolence, I'm sorry. You know, you can, if there's sympathy, there's sympathy. That's a, it's a singular thing. Now, instinct, we said, is not the same thing as intuition. Sympathy is not the same thing as compassion. Compassion has a deeper waking spiritual understanding to it. But if there is just a feeling, a synchronization with the feelings of another person, that is what sympathy is. When a person is sympathetic to what is going on in another person. Now, sympathy is usually an unconscious activity, like many of the activities of the moon. A person is unconsciously sympathetic. People who are con men or con women know this. They know how to draw on a person's sympathy without the person even knowing that their sympathy has been roused. They would just as soon keep it unconscious. However, if one directs, or even a little bit directs the sympathy, then you have an empathy. In an empathy, a person intentionally tries to attune oneself to someone else and harmonize with them. A condolence is a special kind of sympathy and or empathy that has to do with something that is sad. You can have a sympathy, you know, you can have a sympathetic happiness. One kid will start laughing, and pretty soon the whole whole room full of kids will be laughing. That's a sympathy as well. When you're dealing with sympathy and empathy and condolence, you're dealing with things that take place that extend over several people. And you might say a state of feeling that extends over a number of people in place, but especially if it extends over a long period of time, you're talking about a mood. If there is a feeling atmosphere or an emotional atmosphere in which other sub-emotions or activities develop, almost like little creatures in water or something like that, you're talking about mood. And the moon is the planet of mood. Can we stop the cameras for just a second? Do something gauche. I have a runny nose. I got excited about something and I had an emotion. All right, I'm set to go again. All right, let's look at another personification of the moon. We're not even done with the personifications yet, and we've probably got a half an hour under our belt. Personality. Together with the ascendant, personality is ruled by the moon. We have said that the moon is biological. We've said that it deals with gestation and all the biological things after gestation. But the body is not like a machine that you just put together mineral parts. The body is an expression of the spirit that projected the image to which the biological stuff and the mineral stuff was added to become a body. And so we have character that is built right into our body. And our body, not only in the momentary expressions, but the whole stance of the body is a personality. In fact, the moon and ascendant are responsible for that. In fact, the position of the moon at birth is the position of the moon at conception, or 180 degrees from the moon at conception. And now that they have these things that they can determine when conception takes place, they can check these ancient formulae out, and they do work. So what we're talking about here is a persona, the outer vehicle or the outer mask of the inner spirit. It is everything from the spirit which over a long period of time has become objectified and condensed and built into the conception that we call a body. There's a personality that goes right with the body. So there is the moon represents more of the vital changing stance of the personality than the consolidated part. The moon is also what does the consolidation, not only just the mother, but she rules all the forces of consolidation in the body. We'll come back to that at another time again too. But so there is a stance that we have about how things are consolidated and how things are being brought into our physical nature. They have, you know, computer programs and all this. Well, this person's going to look like this in 15 or 20 years. And sometimes they're pretty close. Sometimes they are not. Because the events that we have, and especially the emotions that we bring out through our body, actually begins to change the nature of the body. I'm suffering from that right now because I've had taken an active stance in life where I haven't always had the best posture. And I'm finding very great difficulties getting on for not having had that good posture. So the moon represents stance being built into the physical body. Now a very different kind of personification, and that is women. When we talked about the sun, we said that the sun was more influential in male charts than in female charts. And when we talked about some practical applications of the sun, we said that the sun represented mature men. People not aged, but men who had awakened to most of their responsibilities in life and had awakened to their own self being in the process of taking care of those responsibilities. In a similar way, the moon represents mature women. I guess you could say anyone who is of the age that she has brought forth one child counts as becoming pretty mature. So even somebody in her late 20s would be counted that way. What we're talking about here is an experience of the feminine. When we talked about Venus, we said that that this was woman as lover, or woman as artistifier, or woman as socializer. When we're talking about the moon, we're talking about woman as mother, woman as the personification of the source of everything that comes into visible manifestation. The female body has much more exaggerated lunar cyclicity in it. It has much more bio-instinctual nature in it. So what we're talking here about is receptivity, conscious or subconscious. We're talking about responsiveness, conscious or subconscious. We're talking again about conception, the ability to take something and hold it, consciously or unconsciously. Same thing with formation or preservation or sustenance, or any of those things are lunar qualities. And by looking at the moon in its position in the horoscope, you can see how a given individual relates to them. In this, the moon represents feminine fluidic experience, something that is always cleansing, something that is always supporting. Then we have one last personification of the moon, and that's a hard one to put into words. The depth psychologist would like it very much, especially Theodore Reich, because he comes to the same conclusion that astrologers have come to over hundreds of years, and that is that the moon is the personification of the public. It represents the so-called anyone. Instead of saying any man, as they sometimes do in essays, what they should say is any woman. What we're talking here is we're talking about mass sympathy. We're not talking about society, which is organized and sometimes hierarchical, but we're talking about mass activity, where instincts are some of the only things that masses have in consciousness, in common with each other. So we're talking about crowd psychology, those kinds of stirrings. So for this reason, the moon represents how one relates to society as if it were a great mass of porridge or something like that, flowing through the world, how one relates to that. Some people have the ability to direct public consciousness. Certainly not I, but some people do. And if one is too lunar, or if the moon, say the moon is square to Uranus, or the moon is square to Neptune, it indicates that the person can be overcome by a crowd hysteria or a panic or something like that. And that's what we're talking about with the moon. All right. We got through the personifications in 45 minutes. Symbols of the moon. The moon has a rich symbology. This is the first quarter of the moon. If it's all white, it's the full moon. If it's facing the other direction, it is the last quarter of the moon. And if it is total but dark, it's the new moon. We won't go into what each of the four stations of the moon represents, because that would be a little extraneous to what we're trying to do. But it is, you can make a whole science of studying the moon and astrology, and there are quite a few books written about it. Now, because the moon is so visual, and since it is an archetype that has been around so much, it has been used in different ways as part of universal symbolism. The poet Ovid, who was sort of the poet's poet, saw it more like this. He saw it as the planet of horns. He saw it as a planet of basic instinct, of an animal kind of nature. And you can imagine what he does with it in his Metamorphosis. If you ever like reading poetry, get a good translation of the Metamorphosis. It's a wonderful book of poetry to read. So we say people are horny, and in our times, most people don't know what being horny means. In most of the ruminant animals, if they have big horns, they also have large scrota. And there is a relationship between horn size and scrota, and so that's where the basic folk notion of horniness came to be. So the horns in any animal have always been sacred to the moon. Some mystics claim that they are a sensitivity vehicle for an animal that has horns. You can, as much as by smell, some animals that have horns, if they are in the wild, it seems like they're almost trying to sense what's in the atmosphere or what's in the environment by relating themselves to their horns. Some people, like the anthroposophists, claim that the horn is sensitive to nature forces and can pick them up. So when they make their compost, they take herbs of certain kinds and they pack them together in an animal horn, and then they bury the animal horn at a certain depth, and then the animal horn is receptive to nature forces, and it helps build a compost starter that is very, very strong. It's quite an interesting thing. I've never gone through that part of it, but at any rate, it's... getting long again here. Shakespeare saw the bow as the moon as a bow, as in bows and arrows. A cyclical application and relief of stress. We'll see when we look at Artemis in a few minutes. It is a projector. Richard Wagner took the same symbol and saw it as the Grail cup, as the chalice, which it still is. If you ever see from clairvoyance a picture in the inner worlds, the spinal fire rises, and where the voice box is, it spreads out like a gigantic tulip of fire in color. And the voice box is going to increase greatly as a creative organ. But when Wagner was talking about it, he was talking about it in the receptivity sense. For him, the sword, which was the spine, the Grail sword, and the cup put together were a uniting of the masculine and feminine elements in our inner spiritual consciousness. So this is where one receives the divine mead from the gods and uses it. Other people, beside it being a bowl, they didn't put the string on, they just put a handle on. And they said, the moon is a shield. The moon is, in its own nature, it is truly defensive. It is very protective. That is what instinct does. Until we can self-consciously take care of everything and we can live by faith, we need instincts to take care of us. And so that is another one of the symbols. The Greeks saw, when they looked out at water in the ocean, I don't know how to do it here. I'm not very, not in a drawing place, I'm in a word place. But they saw the moon in the crests of waves, and they saw each wave that was coming in. They said that this was a new cyclical direction of force, wave direction of force. And so the wave activity being ruled by the moon and being a way of conveying things without having to move yourself. If you've ever watched things move through waves, the waves basically stay in place. But what they carry and the energy that is transmitted through them, that is what moves along. A lot of the ancient people saw it as hooves, that is the instinctual animative nature. And if it was hooves with horseshoes, it was a symbol of domestication. And while we're talking about horses, the mane of a horse was seen by the Greeks as being lunar. It was sort of like its expression of excess energy came in that way. It was a representation of the energy that gave the ability to travel, which like a cow didn't have for sure. Some people put the stem on the other side and put it like this. And the moon then is an arc. That is a floating, suspended type of quality, a bobbing kind of suspension. All of the things of the moon, whether it's the colloids that form our foods are not ionic, our foods are colloidal. Those are suspensions. Or our whole body, we are literally suspended in water. yeah, we've got a skeleton, but every organ, every muscle is suspended in a little sac. That's a lunar quality. If we take the ark and put a handle on it, it's an umbrella, another kind of protection, an umbrage. It's sort of like a subconscious protecting of self. If we look at it like this and take the mast away, you have a cradle. The rocking quality, the harmony, the back and forth that doesn't go anywhere any more than waves go anywhere, but yet accomplishes everything. There's something very peaceful in that. I think it isn't, the picture that we have of old people sitting in rocking chairs, I happen to think that's a very good picture. Old people, little children and old people are a lot like each other. A little child will say whatever there is to say and it'll just come out and say it. The same thing with an older person. What's on their mind, they'll tell you. They're letting the social graces, which are a kind of indoctrination, fall away, and they'll tell you outright. And a little child, you can't make a little child do what it doesn't want to do. There's no way. It just if it's no, it's no. And the same thing with an older person. But older people learn that there are some things that, no matter what the world thinks, are very pleasant things to do. And sitting in a rocking chair. And I think it has something to do with the motion of a pendulum. That the sitting in a rocking chair is a really pleasant thing to do, no matter, I'll sit in a rocking chair, no trouble at all, no matter whether it's considered an old man's thing or not. Obviously, it is the semicircle, which we've been talking about. We introduced it in our last talk when we were talking about Mercury. The moon is only semicircle, and therefore the moon is pure soul. And soul, in the sense that we're using it, is in the Aristotelian sense. We're not using it to mean a self or an ego, true or false ego. Soul is that which communicates things between body and spirit. And that's what the moon does. The moon conveys everything. It doesn't convey it in the same way that Mercury does as a means of communicating waking knowledge. It's just that everything flows across the moon. And so all of the astrological forces, if you're doing predictive astrology, the second hand that ticks off the exact moment that something is going to happen is ruled by the moon, by the transiting moon. And so the moon then is that in nature which acts as a soul to convey all things into and out of manifest existence. All right. In mythology, in the Greeks and Romans, it was for the Greeks, Artemis, and for the Romans, Diana. We mentioned this a little bit when we talked about the sun. Artemis is the twin sister of Apollo, and representing the basic masculine and feminine divine forces. She was actually, we talked about it, they're the same size as each other as we see them. And Artemis ruled all kinds of things. Because she's so public and biological, Artemis was the ruler of communicable diseases. Because the moon's the only one that gets around that much, and it rules the public in the first place. But the way we know Artemis the most is as the protectress of children, the protectress of suckling animals. Like if you were unkind to an animal or if you were unkind to a children, that made Artemis your enemy, and she wasn't somebody that you did not want to have as an enemy. Defensive fighters will fight much more wholeheartedly than offensive fighters because they're fighting for the sake of something, right to live. She was also the protectress of mothers and of virgin women, because the moon is the virgin mother. The moon precipitates or crystallizes or finalizes all events without being involved in them herself. That's what Mother Nature is like. So there's a kind of psychic innocence, that kind of quality that we find with the moon in the sense of Artemis. And Artemis, as we know, was the goddess of the chase. And the moon was pictured as Artemis running through the signs of the zodiac and with her bow and arrow chasing all the different animals that were the different signs of the zodiac. So it was a cyclical chase, and all animals do run in circles. Artemis was given a lot of gifts from her father, Zeus, and one of them was eternal, fruitful virginity. She had a plant-like way of creating, that is, she remained virgin. She was given bows and arrows, the arrows of life and death. And she was given as many names as her brother Apollo. And actually, I think if you look at them all, there are more names for the moon than there are for the sun. She was also the queen of the night, with the borrowed light, and psychic light, you might say. She's the patroness of childbirth, and she's the goddess of harbors, and a whole bunch of other things that are not directly relevant to astrology, but harbors being receptive places where there are portals, that is ruled by astrology. She changes her adversaries and people who are unfaithful to the gods into animals. Here we're talking about not letting oneself become too subject to the subconscious or animalistic nature. She is originally the ruler of all of the stars, meaning to say the ruler of night. And she is the one that says which star is going to have influence and which star isn't. She was originally the ruler of incidents, accidents, and circumstances, even the minutiae. And in this, in the Romans called her trivia. All the trivial little things that occur are ruled by the moon. She works and does everything virginally, with the story of the Eleoids were two brothers that thought they were greater. Zeus gave them immortality. And the only way that they could die is if they killed each other. And because they were humans, they didn't know how to use their divinity, and they were causing all kinds of trouble. And Zeus asked Artemis to take care of them. Because they were causing too much trouble. She knew she couldn't kill them, so what she did is she turned herself into a stag. And they were out hunting, and she turned herself into a stag at just the right moment when they both saw it, and they raised their bows, and they were pointing exactly at each other, and then she disappeared, and they killed each other, which is the only way that they could die. And that way of bringing things about, she didn't actually do the killing, but she, in a virgin way, she brought things about, and that's the way the moon functions. The Greeks also had Pallas Athene, or Athena, if you want to call her that. She was born without her own consent. She was born from her father's head. She was born whole, and she was born in armor. She's the ultimate she's the ultimate defender. She killed her best friend and therefore took on her best friend's name with her own, Pallas Athene. Pallas was her friend. She's called a great white goddess, especially of the domestic arts, and especially within the domestic arts, spinning and weaving. The spinner, how frequently something happens, how something spins, has always been associated with the moon. In Christian mysticism, Jehovah is associated with the moon. In Indian mysticism, Shiv is the spinner, is the dancer, and everything turns in circles like that. The weaving, if you look at the orbit of the moon, because of the apsides of the nodes of the moon continuously moving backward around the equator, it looks like something is being woven together if you look at the orbit day by day, week by week, over 19 years. She's not beautiful. She's sort of white and puffy. She didn't win the contest with Paris that time over who was the most beautiful. She invented the flute, not the panpipes, which were invented by Mercury. She invented the trumpet, the earthenware pot, the plow, the bridle, the chariot, and the ship. And each of them gives you a very good picture of the things that the moon is about. She's a goddess of war, but she doesn't relish it. She only defends when defense is necessary. She is a goddess of peace, because the olive is sacred to Athena, and olive has always represented peace. She does things reflectively. Again, this is another side of indirection. She is the one who helped slay the Medusa. She did this by giving this burnished shield that, because if you looked at the Medusa directly, you were turned into stone. And so Perseus, who was to kill the Medusa, was instructed to look at her in his shield and then cut from behind. From behind his head. And that is that reflective kind of way, because the moon reflects the true creation that comes from spirit, reflects it into this physical body. Everything in this physical body we understand by reflection. We actually see everything upside down. And it is our consciousness that inverts it. There have even been experiments where they've made special goggles that when you wear these goggles, you see everything upside down, and it's terribly confusing, except after a few hours, the consciousness rectifies, and even with the goggles on, you see things right side up. And then when you take the goggles off, you're seeing things upside down again. The physiological psychologists have done this. And then you see everything upside down again, but you catch on much quicker and when you re-invert again. And so we live in an inverted world, or we're perceiving the world inverted, and that's that reflective kind of consciousness of the moon. Sometimes you get things all backwards. Our true nature is not lunar. Our true nature is spiritual. And this is why, again, the instinctual or the biological is something that we have to be a little bit careful of. Another moon goddess, Selene, who was a goddess of enchantment. We're talking about a basic or lower kind of nature here. I'm going to have to quit using chalk. I get chalk in my nose, and then I want to sneeze, and my nose runs, and everything else. How would you say it? Things that are brought about through superphysical media, but that are not spiritual, are what we call enchantment. And Selene was a goddess that was much involved with water. In fact, all the priestesses of Selene were not only great magicians, they worked with water a lot. She's seduced by Pan, which indicates the mixing of earth and water, Pan representing earth. And it is that mucky kind of thing that life comes out of, the two of them working together. She's also the goddess of the cloven hoof, but we won't go into that. Another goddess ruled by the moon, it brings out another side and carries it even further, Hecate, the goddess of spells and of witchcrafts and enchantment. And usually her enchantment was done by herbs, because the moon has very close association with plants. In fact, there are treatises written by scientists that show that plants have different characteristics when harvested at different phases of the moon. She's a goddess of the underworld, not as much as Hades is, and she's associated with death and the old hag that is the hag of a nightmare. A mare is that old woman that does that. She's the goddess of bitches, and she is the goddess of anything that is a carcass eater. So she's associated with forces that are in deterioration, not with the forces that build things. She's part of the destroyers. She's also a goddess of darkness and of horrors and of dark magic. This is why magic should never be entered into personally, because when you're personal, you always have a skewed view of things. And when you're personal, therefore, if you start doing magic, you're under that influence of that personal protective point of view, and you don't have the impersonality of a divinity. God is not a respecter of persons that you would have otherwise. You know, there's a whole page of notes missing here, because there are more than Greek and Roman goddesses. But we've had enough of that, and we'll have to move on a little bit more swiftly. Horoscopic figures. People, remember, we're saying that every person in your life represents one or more planets, sometimes a combination of them, and each planet in your life represents one or more people. And in any horoscope, the moon is going to obviously represent the relations with your mother. Now, it may not objectively describe your mother, but it describes how your mother is perceived by you. My mother was an Aries with Capricorn rising. And I didn't perceive her either as Aries or Capricorn rising. I knew she liked to work very, very hard, which is common to Aries. And I knew she was tight as a pinch, which is common to Capricorn. But the part that I knew about my mother was her prayer. My life is, to some extent, what it is because of her prayers. It took many, many years before I realized that in certain circumstances I was saved by her prayers. She had a moon trine, Mars trine Neptune, and so she packed a really powerful prayer. She could galvanize spiritual forces through prayer. In my horoscope, the moon is in Pisces, and so that has a very mystical quality. So my relationship with my mother was mystical. It wasn't her nature, but it was like that. In fact, I even took my mother was second generation, and my grandmother was very superstitious. My mother had some superstitions, and I have to be careful because otherwise I take on some of my own superstitions from her. Like, I remember one time, this actually happened. I used to read different books to my mother. I used to read her art history books and philosophy books and things like that. We didn't like to watch television that much. And I one time started to read her physiology book, and I'd start showing her the pages, and she said, slam the book shut, because she says, you're not supposed to see that. You're not supposed to see what's inside of your body. But at any rate, you see what I'm talking about. If you're the moon in my horoscope does have some problems, but for the most part it's very, very excellent. And so my relationship to my mother and to maternity is very good. And it turns out, because men are deficient in the lunar qualities as far as their responsiveness to the moon, they look to them. So men tend to marry their mothers in the same way that women tend to marry their fathers. Another personification is people who nurture you, people who take care of you, people who feed you and things like that. I have this thing with, cancer is on the cusp of my 11th house. And so my friends are ruled by the moon. And my friends are very hegemonous. They all want to feed me, and they want to feed me things I don't want to eat. I got that persnickety, that fussy Virgo. I only want to eat this kind of thing, and I want to eat it this way. And then my friends want to dress me. And what happens is this gets out of control. Because when, now, of all of the people that I associate with in my life and have had the closest associations are people that have usually the moon or the sun in the last 6 degrees of Pisces. That's the biggest activity point in my life. And that's where a lot of my friends are. But what happens is somebody gives you an item of clothing, and then in their hegemonous way, they want you to wear it. And if you wear it, because it really isn't you, somebody else sees you with that and they say, that's incongruous. He shouldn't be wearing that. I'll give him what he should be wearing. And pretty soon you're like a scarecrow. You have all of these different clothes that different. The thing of it is, I don't have to look at the clothes. For doing that to me, they have to look at them. Protectors. Anyone who would be protective of you. My friends are tremendously protective of me. I have friend, my closest friend in the entire world. I have this thing. I don't understand women very well. Women as women. And as a consequence, I'm vulnerable to any woman and every woman, because normally you're attracted to what you aren't. And if there's a specific thing that you aren't, that's the kind of woman that you're attracted to, because you need that for your experience. Well, I'm attracted to all kinds of women because I don't know anything about the feminine. And so I'm not really a skirt chaser, but I like them all. My closest friend in the world knows me. And anytime she sees me getting in a relationship with somebody that I shouldn't be in, she, using her own attractiveness, because knows that I love her more than anyone else in the entire world, uses her own attractiveness to pull me out, and has done that I'm wise to it now, but two or three times in life this has happened. We're talking about the Oriental woman. Feelers. People who set moods for you or bring you to feel things. People who stimulate your imagination. I can remember when I was a child, my friends of my parents in their courting days were living in Milwaukee. And then we moved out to this little farm, and all the friends would come during the summertime for a weekend. They'd come out to the farm. And one set of friends had a daughter that was about my age, and I always looked forward to her coming because she stimulated the imagination. I can remember it as clear as can be. She, at one occasion, she says, "The eyes, the eyes!" And then we were all running around wondering what the, and everybody got all excited about it. And every time we'd go in the barn, she'd say, "There the eyes are!" And then finally, at the end of the day, she pointed out to us that in the wall of the barn, there were two holes, and the light came in like that, and they looked like eyes. You know, it awakens all kinds of excitement and all kinds of... And I like associating with people who get me excited. Sharaji, who is probably out eating tonight with the friends, he and I share that together. We both get excited about something, and we laugh a lot when we get so excited in that way. People who stimulate the most sympathy in you. And that's usually for me, my partners. I have sympathy on them after a while.
So does everyone else.
Yeah. people who domesticate us or who civilize us, sort of tame us. In my case, that was my wife. My moon is in the seventh house. I have pictures of what I used to dress like and how I never washed my hair but maybe once a month or something like that. I was something of a greaser before she got a hold, before she got a hold of me. But you get the whole picture. Women, just in general. All right, colors. Green, especially nature greens that are live and vital and rich. Blue greens, aqua green, teal green, all of those are lunar colors. Silvers, reflective silver things. And to some extent with Saturn, the grays. If there is a conservative kind of gray that is not too stiff, but it is sort of a comfortable conservative gray, that is a lunar gray. Elements, silver, highly conductive, it's disinfectant, and it's photoactive. It has that quality of silver nitrate producing photographs. That's the impressionability of the moon carried out very well. It has a ringing quality, as in bells. Aluminum, very light, very reflective. Unfortunately, people tried to cook with it. Selenium, photoreceptive. And selenium, if trace amounts of selenium were fed to everybody, especially in the eastern half of the United States, there would be a reduction of cancer. In states where there's a statistical thing that in selenium-rich soil that there is less cancer. Chlorine. In pure, it's very cleansing, but it is common to salt, salinity. And therefore, it helps growth. There are two families of salts in the human body. One is the sodium salts, which are the interstitial salts, the extracellular salts. That includes sodium and calcium and a few things like that. And then within the cells where the life is taking place are the potassium family, which is phosphorus and magnesium and that whole family of along with potassium. But the chemistry of the human body is basically potassium, except in three different conditions. In the first 6 weeks of life, if a woman is pregnant or if you have cancer, everything goes over toward the sodium side. And cancer is an amorphous protein growth inside of a salt water sac. And during gestation, that's basically a saltwater sac for growing and forming the body. And so chlorine is responsible for producing the condition for formative forces to work. That's said almost like an Aristotelian, but you have to forgive me once in a while. Plants, trees, herbs, and foods. Palms are ruled by the moon. Olives are ruled by the moon, and the kind of tree that we see here all the time, willows. In fact, that whole family, though there are sub-memberships within it, the willow family, which includes the birches and all of those things. All of the fluids that we take into our body, especially water, milk, all dairy things with the exception of cheese are ruled by the moon. All of the solanaceae are ruled by, again, that's a family ruling, and there are sub-rulerships within. Especially eggplant and belladonna are ruled by the moon. That has rulership and sub-rulership. The cucurbitaceae are ruled by the moon, especially the melons and the cucumbers. Drawing herbs, like chickweed that will draw poison out of you. Any herb that is a stomachic or that is a demulcent, especially if there are good relationships between Venus and the moon. The planetary emissary, that is, we're saying that each planet has an archangel whose consciousness is shared with us and which we can draw upon for working with the things ruled by that archangel. We don't talk to the archangel outside of us. We talk to the archangel inside of us that is part of our own being that is in sympathetic vibration with the archangel outside. Well, the moon is only a satellite, and it does not have an archangel. It has an angel. And so the emissary from the moon is Gabriel. So if you take the moon's day, which is Monday, when everybody does their laundry, and at sunrise, which is the beginning of the moon hour, if you're pondering on things like your physical nature or other things that are ruled by the moon, what to do with relation to your mother, that's the best time to do something of that kind. Anatomy and physiology. The mammaries and lactation are ruled by the moon. The uterus is ruled by the moon. This is a connection that goes back to hysterectomies, because the moon, especially with Uranus, indicates hysterical emotions. And when people were hysterical, they thought that was a lunar condition, and therefore if they removed the uterus, they would be less likely to that. That's the answer of medicine. If there's something you don't like in the body, cut it out. Tear ducts are ruled by the moon. Sweat is ruled by the moon. Obviously, for women, the menses are ruled by the moon. Blood plasma. All of the fluids, basically, that function as fluids. Mucus, synovium, phlegm, interstitial fluids, lymph, all lunar. You can see why the moon has such a big influence on the personality, since most of the body is water, and water is ruled by it. The esophagus is ruled by the moon, together with Cancer, as is the stomach. The eyes, to some extent, but again, there's a specialization. In men, it is the right eye, the left eye that is ruled by the moon. And in females, it is the right eye that is ruled by the moon. Some digestive fluids, not all of them. It is very much a primitive. It's probably the most primitive of all the planets. It is a variable. It can take on positive or negative. It's sort of a neutral-like planet. Not quite as neutral as Mercury, but still neutral. It has no activation. It is a producer or a materializing planet. It is a personal planet, meaning that it is inside the planet of the Earth, and for tradition, for hundreds if not thousands of years, is that the sphere of the moon is the first sphere that we overcome with self-consciousness. It is the planetary opposite of the sun. And it has a special character that is all of its own. It is the planet's planet. That is, in the same way that the planets focus the signs and constellations into the solar system to be used, the moon focuses all of the above, including the planets. So it is the ultimate focuser. It is the ultimate nocturnal planet, being cold and damp and all of those qualities we associate with night. And it's independent in its own motion, even to the sun. And it is a feminine planet. It's probably the most feminine. It rules Cancer, so wherever the moon is will affect whatever is happening in Cancer, and whatever is happening in Cancer will be affected by the moon. I give you my own example. Having Cancer on the cusp of the 11th house and the moon in the 7th house. I'll give you another example of how that worked. My wife developed her whole set of friends through me. You know, I was almost like, for a while, I felt I was a conduit to her friendships for her. In short, my friends became her friends. Suppose somebody has cancer on the 2nd house. That would be somebody that may have their income derived from working with nature or medicine or something like that. And suppose if the moon is in the 10th house, that would be somebody that would be a professional moon. And the income then might be a doctor, and it would be tied together in that way. On the other hand, it might be a doctor whose professional decisions are influenced by money. We see that one happening quite a great deal. If the moon is on the 6th house, it is someone that the emotions control the state of health. Not the thoughts, but the emotions. And the ups and downs in health and vitality depend a lot then on what's happening in cancer. Suppose the moon is in the 9th house, that would indicate that a way of stabilizing the emotions and helping the health would be through some kind of belief system or something that was edifying, that was productive of faith, that they could live through any kind of situation. The moon has its detriment in Capricorn. And with its detriment in Capricorn, Capricorn is the sign of crystallization. It makes all those beautiful crystals in the mineral kingdom, but it's awfully brittle, and the moon wants things fluid. It has its exaltation in Taurus. And the special quality that comes out there is a kind of clannishness. It's sort of like a family that sticks together and makes money together. You find that kind of thing in ethnic subcultures in the United States. It has its fall in Scorpio, because Scorpio is too destructive, and for somebody that wants to be that protective and that generative, the destructiveness is too hard. When it's in the east, when the moon is anywhere in the 1st house or halfway up into the 12th house, it's called in the east. And it rounds the body and it tends to soften it. Often it's a puffy kind of body, like you feel like you can put your finger in and it would just sink way in. Sometimes it's round-faced, and sometimes it adds to a witchy profile. It generally tends to pale the complexion. The person seems much whiter. Very often the moon in the east is somebody who's moody. And the moon in the east is often somebody who is instinctive, especially somebody that's easily scarable. The moon in the east is likely to be extremely changeable type of person, and there's one special kind of changeability that comes out. Often with the moon in the east, there is wanderlust. The moon in the east often indicates hyper-impressionability, depending on the sign it's in. Sometimes it inflates the cheeks,